Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be.
Hi, I'm Carol Fitzgerald, host of the Book Reporter Talks To video podcast series. Welcome to our first live Book Reporter Talks To event. Our special guest this afternoon is William Kent Krueger, and we are going to be talking about his latest novel, The River We Remember. For today's program, we're going to switch things up a little bit. Usually I'm the one that does all the questions. Well, recently we had 25 readers win a contest, and they all shared their comments about this book after they read it. And the reader questions were so good that came in with this, along with their comments, that we've decided to have them be the people who are answering the question, asking the questions today. Some of the people are live here to share their questions. Others, I'm going to be sharing their questions. And we already have so many. That's the reason we're not going to go to Q&A today. If you want to drop into the chat with the city and state you're from, and if you want to share what you're reading as well, we always want to hear that. And with that housekeeping behind us, welcome, Kent.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Carol. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
It is always, always so much fun. And I love that we're trying something different with you for the very, very, very first time. You know, first, let me start and congratulate you on all your success thus far with The River We Remember. It's a New York Times bestseller, but that's not all, folks. It's also a bestseller with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, Publishers Weekly. And last week, it was named one of the best mysteries of the year by Barnes & Noble. And these are huge kudos, and I expect more to come in as the year wraps up with more best of lists, because this is a really, really, really special book. So right now, you're on the tail end of an almost 50 locations tour. I mean, seriously, Kent, I don't know how you were doing it. I was looking at the schedule. There were two events some days. Do you have laryngitis at any point?
Well, there were times when my throat hurt so much, I thought, oh, I've got COVID, but it was just from exhausting my voice, my vocal cords.
It was great, though. You know, we've got a wonderful group of readers ready today. And just so the audience knows, we are not going to talk any spoilers. We specifically have done these questions, so we won't do spoilers. Try and do another event with Ken later, perhaps when the paperback comes out, and make a book group about this, where we will do that. But today we're not going to do it. So first joining us is Nancy Robinson from Joy, Illinois, and she's going to jump on and share her question with us.
Hi, so I'm very excited to get to ask my question. So, Kent, you address many social, moral complexities in The River We Remember, post-war results, small-town structure, and the anger that manifests itself in people and their actions, among many others. With so many threads in the plot, I wonder, where does the first seed of the story start?
Well, I can pretty much tell you where the seed of this story began. At the heart of The River We Remember is an issue that I have puzzled over my whole life. In the early 1940s, my father graduated from high school, enlisted in the military service, and marched off to Europe to fight in World War II. He was just a kid. He was 18 years old. He came back several years later, a man deeply wounded in body and in spirit by what the war had done to him. I recognize now that he was probably suffering from PTSD, but nobody talked about that back then. Or if they did, they called it battle fatigue or shell shock. When I was a kid, like all kids, I pestered my father for war stories. Tell any Germans, Dad? He absolutely refused to talk about the war. And it was very like the fathers of my friends, guys who, like my dad, had fought in World War II or the Korean War. And all of them went away kids, you know, some of them not even old enough to shave yet. And they came back men deeply wounded in spirit and in body by the horrors that they had seen and the horrors that they had been a part of. And I've wondered all my life, how would anyone heal from that kind of wounding? And what about the people they left behind, the ones who loved them, their wives, their mothers, their fathers, their sisters, people who I'm sure were praying for them desperately while they were away fighting, and maybe who in the end lost them on the battlefield? How did they heal from their wounds? How could anybody find a way to heal from that kind of wounding? And so for a very long time, I've wanted to write a story that would help me dig deeper into that question. And finally, I decided it was time to give it a shot with The River We Remember.
Just a beautiful, beautiful job with it. Debbie Moore is going to join us right now from Liverpool, New York. And Debbie is a frequent person who joins us for our Bocachino live events in the evening. So I was glad to see her want to be a part of this as well.
Hi, Kent. It's really a pleasure to meet you. You kind of answered my question when you answered Nancy's question. So I'm just going to say how much I love all your books. I've read them all. I love the Corporal O'Connor series, and I've loved all of your standalones. This is probably my favorite story at all. I think partly because I grew up in the 1950s in a small town.
Yeah.
But I want to say that as much as I enjoy this book, my favorite character of all your characters is Henry Malou. And I love Henry Malou. So I just want you to know that. So I'm anxiously awaiting the next Corporal O'Connor, just because I want to hear more from Henry Malou. But thank you for all your writing. It's really, really wonderful. Every story that you write touches my heart.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that, Debbie. Thank you so much. And Henry Malou, for those of you who are watching who might not be familiar with my mystery series, before I began to write standalone novels, I was probably best known as the author of the, I love saying this, New York Times best-selling Cork O'Connor mystery series. For those of you unfamiliar with that work, I set those stories up in the North Country of Minnesota in the Great North Woods. My protagonist, Cork O'Connor, is a man of mixed heritage. He's part Irish-American and he's part Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, which is the largest tribal affiliation we have in northern Minnesota. And one of the recurring characters in that story is a guy named Henry Malou. He's the nearest thing I write to a stock character, the wise old medicine man. He is indeed a healer. He's a member of the Grand Medicine Society, Mide. He is indeed old. He's 107 as I'm writing him in my current manuscript. He's the guy that Cork turns, he's Cork's mentor, really. He's the guy Cork turns to whenever things are so knotted up, Cork doesn't know up from down. And Henry, through his wisdom, helps guide him along. He tends to be, although it's called the Cork O'Connor series, he tends to be the favorite of most readers. I certainly love writing those scenes in which Henry Malou is going to play a part. And because he's 107, I often get questions about how long Henry is going to be with us. I want to assure you, Henry will be with us for quite some time.
Henry's going to be the longest, the oldest character out there. Now, be able to do that. Mary Pat is now joining us from Mandan, North Dakota. I love this. I love that we have people from across the country. It really makes my day. Mary Pat, so good to see you.
It's great to be here. And can't I echo the sentiments of all of your readers? I just can't put your books down. I've reread several and passed them along to friends with the promise that they return them to me.
I hope you get them back.
I hope so. Well, too, most of the time I do. There's a promise made every time. But I've got several questions for you today. You introduce a large cast of characters in this book. And by the time we finish chapter 6, about 40 pages in, we have met 22 characters. I took notes. And that certainly was by design. So why did you expand the cast so much larger in this book than in other books you've written?
Well, thanks for the question, Mary Pat. And I appreciate that you think it was by design. Going into the writing of The River We Remember, I only had a general idea of where the story was going to go, how I was going to accomplish what I hoped to accomplish. This is a small town, Jewell, Minnesota, and a small town is a very close-knit community. And so what I wanted to do early on is to give a sense of the web of relationship in the community. I realized that there are characters in the beginning that I introduce who really don't play much of a role in it, but they offer something in the beginning of the story. And although I thought briefly about creating a cast of characters so readers could keep track, where I finally came down on was the realization that, or the hope, that as readers get into the story, they won't care about the characters that I'm not talking about anymore, and they'll focus on the ones who begin to play more and more significant role in the story, particularly the four or five voices through which the story is actually told. 22, huh? I'm gobsmacked, actually.
I sat with a legal pad and wrote them down.
Well, typically, you know, I try to be careful about what I have the reader try to keep track of. But as I said, I had no idea where the story was going to go or what I was going to do with everyone. So I hope that it didn't distract from your ability to focus on the important events and the important characters.
I think it just gave us a sense of did they do it? It added that whodunit factor, I thought.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that because, you know, as a mystery writer, and this is definitely a mystery, although it's really a whole lot more than just a mystery. When you write a mystery, one of the things I've learned across all of these years as a mystery writer is what you try to do is cast the net of suspicion as broadly as possible, because you don't want your reader to look too early at the, you know, perp, the one who in the end is responsible actually for what has occurred. So I'm glad to hear that.
Great. So many themes of conflict were woven into the story: betrayal, prejudice, sexual abuse, lingering trauma from war, and murder. When you write, do you jockey back and forth, writing several chapters at once? And how do you map out and start the writing process regarding these conflicts and all of the characters who live through them?
Map out, huh? You give me a whole lot more credit than I'm due. You know, when I write a story, I follow two different processes. When I write a story in my Cork O'Connor series, those are all mysteries. And a mystery is a very tightly woven fabric of storytelling. Everything depends so significantly on everything else. And I think that the success of a mystery depends largely on the timing of the reveals. When do you give the reader the clues that are going to be necessary for solving the mystery at the heart of the story? So when I write a Cork O'Connor manuscript, I try to think that story through as completely as I can before I ever put my fingers to the keyboard. At the end of that thinking process, which can take several months, I know how the story begins. I know how it ends. I know who did what to whom and why. I know the themes that I want to weave through the piece. But when I have approached a mystery is an intellectual construct. It's a puzzle that you're creating in your head, and you're trying like crazy to make sure all the pieces fit perfectly together. My standalones, Ordinary Grace, This Tender Land, and The River We Remember, didn't come from my head. It came from my heart. And I wanted a process that was more organic, that might help the reader feel that I was telling them this story straight from my own heart. And so going into the writing of these three standalones, I really had only a vague idea of where I was going to go with it. And so the themes emerged as I was writing them. As the story revealed itself to me, the themes themselves sort of arose naturally. And so I could figure I'm going to focus on this. I see this coming up. Let's work that into the story. Let's somehow weave that into the fabric. I wish I could say, I had planned it out perfectly. But I did this was one of the most difficult manuscripts I have ever tackled. And I did more rewriting of this manuscript than I have done with any other manuscript. In fact, truthfully, this manuscript was contractually due to my publisher 6 years ago. But when I finished that first draft, it was clear to me that I didn't know the story well enough, or I hadn't heard the voice of the story speak to me in significant enough way that I could do the story justice. So I put it on the shelf and didn't come back to work on it until the pandemic descended and I ran out of other story ideas. then I took this manuscript off the shelf, this mangled manuscript, this failed manuscript, and took another look at it. And Mary Pat, I don't know what happened across those 6 years, but I heard the voice of the story speaking to me now in an authentic way. So I spent the next year and a half completely revising the story into a piece that I really, really deeply love and believe in profoundly.
Mm-hmm. I think as your readers felt that writing from the heart. I can surely attest to that. When you started writing, you must have had the killer planned from the start. But do you ever deviate? Do you ever deviate from your decision once you start the writing process?
Well, I had a general idea of how the story might play out. And as I wrote, it became clear to me that, that was a good motive in the end for things to play out the way that they played out. I have written stories where things did change significantly. Things have changed. even in the Cork O'Connor series, which I try to think through as completely as I can in the right. You know, every storyteller learns that at some point a story takes on an energy of its own. And as a storyteller, despite what you think you were going to accomplish, you have to be willing to step back and let that story go where it wants to go. I've written stories whose endings were very different from what I had intended. And that readers let me know they were really unhappy with the way I ended that particular novel. But it was the way the story spoke to me. And so I try to be true to the energy of a story. So sometimes things do change. And sometimes in small ways and sometimes in very significant ways. And I think if you talk to any storyteller, you're going to get the same story from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for your work.
You're so welcome. Thanks for your questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mary Pat.
Yeah.
Now we've got Tracy Case joining us from Fernandino Beach, Florida. Did I do it right? Did I say that right?
Fernandino, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I retired to Florida 2 years ago, originally from Ohio, but yes. My question to you is, I've read your three standalones now, This Tenderland, Ordinary Grace, and now The River We Remember, and your teenage boy characters are filled with questions, courage, angst, and very hard choices. Did you base these boys on your own life?
Yeah, kinda. You know, for those of you who haven't read the other standalones, Ordinary Grace, both Ordinary Grace and This Tender Land have a dual narrative going on. It's narrated by an older individual looking back on a time much earlier in his life when things occurred. And the much earlier time in the lives that they're looking back on typically is about 13 years of age, which was an important period in my own life. So I often return to that period to create the stories, because I so vividly remember what the world was like and what I was like and what kinds of questions I have. I find that adolescent male voice is a very easy thing for me to capture. Mm-hmm. And maybe in part that's because I have always believed men never really mature much past 13 years of age. You know, look at all the toys we buy for ourselves. They just get bigger and more expensive. So I really like asking the questions that those, and I'm sure women do too, that we ask as we are standing in that threshold to our adulthood, when we're beginning to understand the world is very different, more mysterious, more complex than we had ever imagined. And somehow we have to find a way to navigate through all of the complexities that are out there in front of us. So we're asking ourselves, who are we? We have an image of what our parents want us to be. Is that who I want to be? I have seen the world in one particular way, but my gosh, the world is a whole lot more frightening than I possibly imagined. And so I like taking the adolescent into those first few steps of adulthood, because I think it's also an experience. This coming of age is an experience that we all have gone through and that we all can relate to profoundly. I think it's a universal, and it continues to call back to me. So if you were to read my Cork O'Connor series, number 18 in that series is a prequel that takes Cork at hit the age of 12 or 13 years old, because I will probably go back to that age again for some stories in the future, because I just so love dealing with that.
Yes. Well, I had a 13-year-old son, and now I have a 13-year-old grandson, so I understand completely, and those characters resonated well with me. So
I'm happy to hear that.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us, Tracy. So Sharon Elliott Fox from Jeffersonville, Indiana, couldn't join us today, but she's got some questions that I'm going to ask. What is the purpose in showing that almost every character is deeply flawed or hurt person? Many have fears of their sins, present or past, being exposed. Yet you show there is an abundance of acceptance within the community and a desire to assist each other in some way. Do you feel that the willingness to accept in spite of what are less than wonderful qualities is a primary gift of a small community as opposed to a larger city, where people often do not know each other as intimately and do not see one another almost daily?
Well, what I try to offer the reader are realistic characters, and the truth about what it is to be human is to be broken, is to be wounded, is to be full of flaws, full of failings, and that's not just true of small towns, that's true of people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I was trying to get at in The River We Remember, and this is a theme I've returned to from Ordinary Grace as well, and even This Tender Land, is that healing begins when we embrace what it is to be human in all of its brokenness and woundedness and all of its falterings and its failings. Healing begins when we can forgive ourselves for the harm that we've caused others and forgive others for the harm that they've caused us. And so as I write my stories, what I'm trying to do is bring the story to that place where I have, I hope, created a story that helps the reader understand that belief that I have. And I think if I were to set the story, I would never set a story, I don't think, in a city, because it's just an atmosphere, an environment, a setting that doesn't particularly appeal to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I talk about in terms of small towns and how people react to one another can be true in a city, because although cities are large and we tend to think of them as this place of anonymity and all, there are communities within the cities. You know, you create a community of friends and a community in the workplace and, you know, whatever. So that the same dynamics, I think, play out everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the small town, you just feel like everybody's like, oh, this is what's happening. This is what's happening in a different way. But yeah, I see what you mean. Even in a city, you know the people in your building. Your building could be the size of the towns that you're creating, actually. And you know so-and-so does this or so-and-so. And even if you don't know their name, you know something about them.
Exactly.
It's like watching out the window since I've been home working. And you see, well, that people with the brown dog, the people with the white dog. So,
but because I grew up, I spent so much of my growing up years in small towns. Mm-hmm. It's really the small town environment that appeals to me when I write a story, because I know it so well and it speaks so deeply to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great memories. Candace Luther from Marshall, Wisconsin asked me to ask this question for you. I'm interested to know what influences you had in your life that helps you write to create the strong female characters that you write.
I have strong women in my life. So here's, that's a flip answer, but here's kind of where that goes back to. I have had strong women in my life. I'm married to a very strong woman. When I decided, for a very long time, I tried to write the great American novel to no great effect. And when I hit my early 40s and decided, the hell with trying to write the great American novel, I want to write something somebody might actually want to read. I looked around me to see what everybody reads. Carol, you know what everybody reads. They read
mm-hmm.
mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
It's a genre whose appeal cuts across all socioeconomic levels, all age demographics, all ethnic groups. So I decided I was going to write a mystery. Here's a confession coming from a mystery writer. Before I began to write mysteries, I didn't read them.
Really?
Yeah, well, my father was a high school English teacher, and he had convinced me that mysteries were the poor stepchildren of literature. So I didn't even read Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys when I was growing up. And I had a lot to learn about mysteries if I was going to write them. So I took, here in the Twin Cities, we have a place called The Loft, which is the largest independent center devoted to the written word in the United States. So I signed up for a class at The Loft, which was basically Mystery Writing 101. It worked. I wrote my first, the first chapter for my first published novel, Iron Lake, first novel in the Cork O'Connor series, in that class. When the class was finished, a bunch of us who liked that reading and critiquing process got together and formed a mystery writers critique group that's still going on today, 25 years later. It's called, get this, Creme de la Crime. And the makeup of that group, the demographic of that group, gender wise, was always at least 50-50, but very often more women than men. And one of the things that I loved about that critique group was that the women would not let the men get away with any of the false assumptions we make about women. I can't tell you the number of times some of the women who were critiquing would go, oh, Kent, That's what you wish women were thinking. So I had a good deal of guidance in creating women characters. But here's just a piece of sort of wisdom across all these years. I'm aware that a large portion of my reading public are women. Mm-hmm. Women read fiction more than men. And so when I write a story, I'm aware that I would like to create strong women characters so that those readers who are female have something to relate to mm-hmm. as they read the story. It's not all just guy stuff.
Not just the gun. It's not just how does the gun work. It's got to be more. It's got to be emotion. Beverly Kimberly from Portland, Oregon asked me to ask this question. In this tender land and the river we remember, a river is a significant character in the books. Has a river had a significant meaning in your life?
So this question came from Portland, Oregon, which is right on the Columbia River. I spent a number of years living right on the Columbia River. I lived east of Portland in the Columbia River Gorge, a little town called Hood River. And so that river has always loomed huge in my imagination. Even when I was a kid, though, living in the heartland, the lure of rivers was pretty mighty. You know, Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, rivers big. I live in a city that mm-hmm. is divided by one of the great rivers of the world, the Mississippi River. And so rivers are always there in my thinking, in my memories, in my imagination. And for me, rivers offer the opportunity to function as metaphors for so many things. So if you were to look at my standalones, the rivers become a metaphor for our journey from childhood into adulthood, that coming of age. They're metaphors for the spiritual journey that I think we're all on. They're metaphors for the creation of family. There's so many ways in which you can use a river beyond just the physicalness of the river itself. Mm-hmm. It ties the past and the present. It ties the landscape to the psychic events that are going on.
Now, so then when something happens at the riverhead, you could sit there and say, oh, here's the start of what goes on. The river is going to play a role in what happens as well.
Yeah.
So Kimberly Goble from Chappaqua, New York is joining us next. I love this.
Way to go.
I love this book. Hi, thank you for doing this. Before I ask my questions, I have to tell you, this is the first time I ever won anything. And so to be able to get an arc of your book, one of my favorite authors on the planet, I was so thrilled. And then I was surprised that it wasn't Cork, who I adore. but this is, I believe, the best book you've ever written. Absolutely lyrical and beautiful. And I read it in a day and a half and then gave it to my parents and said, you got to give it right back to me. So just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
Some of the questions I have already been answered. But one of the things that I've wondered, are these characters that you've thought of before? Are they characters that maybe you didn't include in a Cork O'Connor book or one of your other standalones and you kind of held on to them?
Thank you for the question, Kimberly. So often in my work, I have dealt with characters who are real and I fictionalize them in many ways. Very often it's my family members that I tap to write about. Yeah, sometimes they recognize themselves and sometimes they don't. You know, in The River We Remember, it's really populated by a variety of characters, some of whom I have probably written about before and have resurrected in a new shape, and some that serve the purpose of this particular story. Mm-hmm. Characters that are brand new to me that just came to me as I was creating this story, Charlie Bauer, the aging female attorney who has fought for justice all her life. And as Charlie entered the story she began to reveal herself to me. She was just so unique and different for me as a character. I mean, here's this woman who You know, she smokes cigars and drinks whiskey. She's probably gay. You know, she doesn't care how she dresses or what the populace of the town thinks of her. She's just really on her own journey and proud to be there. I loved Charlie and making her a part of the story. Brody Dern, there's probably some of Cork O'Connor in Brody Dern. Mm-hmm. Although I tried to make him unique in his own way. He certainly behaves in some ways that Cork would never behave in. he's a very complex individual, and sometimes he does things that make you wonder about his moral compass. But I wanted to work on a character who was definitely flawed, definitely struggling, somebody that you could embrace as fully human and care about in the end and find it in your heart to forgive him for those trespasses that he is responsible for. Angie Madison, completely unique in my thinking. The part that she played really evolved as I wrote the story. Her son, Scott Madison, though, is a familiar character. You know, Odie O'Banion in this Tender Land, Frank Drum in Ordinary Grace, familiar character, young man on the edge of his, you know, an adolescent on the threshold of his manhood, trying to figure out life, who he is, what it means to be a man, particularly in a post-war environment mm-hmm. where so much of how we measured manhood was, you know, our ability to have fought in a war and survived a war and be a hero, you know, those kinds of things. So here's a kid who's struggling and understand what it is to be a man. Mm-hmm. Let's see. The character of Noah Bluestone, his mm-hmm. character I have touched on in the past in many ways, a Native American who has grown up, you know, in a white culture and has been the subject of all of the prejudices that so many of our Native brothers and sisters have experienced in their lives. And so he stands really for kind of a whole culture who's struggling against those outdated, they never were appropriate stereotypes that we hold. Some of them have been there before in the stories that I've written, and some are completely new. Connie. I love Connie, Conrad.
Yeah.
But I have kind of written him before as well. If you were familiar with Ordinary Grace, he's kind of an older version of Gus. So and I think to a degree, these are universal characters. They're kind of iconic characters. And they often have played a role in storytelling forever. Mm-hmm. So if you were to look at Connie or at Gus, these are people who offer wisdom, or Henry Malou. These are people who offer the wisdom of the ages to us and keep us grounded. Yeah. And there are those people who are struggling, the human beings who are struggling, our hero figures who are flawed, but are still struggling in an heroic way to do what they believe is right. So universals.
Yeah. So you already spoke about your dad being a veteran, which I didn't know until today, because almost every single one of your books touches on or has characters that are veterans. And I think that's incredible. So instead of asking you a question about it, I'm just going to comment. But I'm gonna add a question since two of them had already been answered, if that's okay. Where's the beginning of your respect and appreciation for the First Nations people? Because it's sincere in your books, it's poignant, and it's not done very well or very often by other authors, in my opinion.
It's probably done more often than you're aware of.
Okay.
In fact, what you're seeing in publishing these days, thank God, are a lot of Native voices, authentic Native voices.
More now, yes.
And putting out just fine work. I have to be perfectly honest with you. My relationship with the Ojibwe here in Minnesota, the Anishinaabeg, began for mercenary reasons. After my wife and I first moved to Minnesota about 40 years ago, we began doing what everybody in the Twin Cities does in the summer. We began vacationing up north, the beautiful lake country, you know, Paul Bunyan country. And when I discovered how beautiful that area was, I knew this is where I want to set my work when I get serious. And when I took a really good look at the North Country of Minnesota, I realized you can't tell a true story set up north without including the Anishinaabeg as an element of the work, because their influence up north is ubiquitous. It's everywhere and it's powerful. What did I know about the Ojibwe when I made that decision? About what every person knows about the white, the native folks we live shoulder to shoulder with, almost nothing. But I was a cultural anthropology major in college, and so learning about this culture was exciting to me. And I began in the way all good academics begin. I began by reading. And then in the course of my research, I began to meet members of the Ojibwe community and form relationships that have over all these years become important friendships. I rely on my Ojibwe friends for their insights, their perceptions, their suggestions. A lot of the stories in the Corco Connor series have come from issues that my friends in the Native community have enlightened me about, and that I have in turn tried to enlighten a broad white reading public about. Whenever I finish a manuscript in the Corco Connor series, I'll give it to at least one, but usually two of my Ojibwe friends to read and vet for me. So I haven't said anything that's really stupid or even worse, offensive.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the truth. You know, our ancestors did their best to erase the Native people from this continent. And yet here they are. They're still with us. And my friends in the Ojibwe community are so dedicated to preserving their culture and their language. And, you know, they haven't lost their sense of humor. I have nothing but great respect and admiration for the Ojibwe people and the Dakota people here in Minnesota.
Mm. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I love all the insight.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thanks for the question, Kimberly.
Kimberly, thanks for the good questions. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Candace Brenner couldn't attend. She's from Mansfield, Ohio. And she asked a question, who is the voice of the prologue?
You know, that first iteration of the story over 6 years ago that was such a failure was an attempt to discover the voice of the story. And I had it told by one of the characters. I'm not really going to tell you who that was at this point, or maybe ever. But it just didn't work. And when I opened the manuscript 6 years later and began to read it, I realized this was a story that didn't require a particular voice.
Mm-hmm.
This was a story that I wanted the voice to come out of the place itself, as if the place were speaking to you. And so it's not a particular person who is giving you the narrative, that the prologue, or giving you the epilogue. It is essentially the voice of this place,
mm-hmm,
delivering the story. Yeah. And, you know, it's not a new narrative technique. I just really appreciated its ability to allow me to dip into various characters without being in a confusing situation. I hope it wasn't a confusing situation.
No, you know, what's really interesting is so many times I read the prologue of a book and I realize I have to come back at the end, because the prologue is, wait, what are we talking about here? We're coming into something. And I always say to people, go back and read the prologue at the end, because it's going to see like how it all got wrapped together. Because a lot of times you are reading and you're like, you're reading blind when you open the book. And then later on, oh, now I see, said the wise man.
Yeah, I love prologues. I love prologues because they are a very quick way to hook a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, and you can hook a reader in a lot of ways. You can put questions out there and leave them unanswered. You can create a character that's intriguing for them to latch onto. You can create a sense of place. So when I write a prologue like for the River We Remember, what I wanted to do was, first of all, give a sense of this place. And then with that final sentence, I hope, hook readers in so that they've got to read beyond that prologue.
Got to turn the page. So joining us right now is my good friend, Emery Pelayo from Westfield, New Jersey. Emery is always early. I'm always late, or Emery's always early. So Emery popping on, that was just perfect, Emery. It was so in your style. It was all you. No, it's perfect. It's Emery's style. Carol's always late, her style, you know? So I know you have some questions for us. Go ahead.
So I have a few questions, Kent. And I was going to ask about the river as a metaphor. You're telling us that your dad was an English teacher, and your beautiful explanation of metaphors really sort of said it all. So I have this question instead. How do you decide if a book should be a series or a standalone? Is it because there are unfinished themes that stay with you? Is it because the characters stay with you long after you're done writing? Is it because you're still drawn to the town or location of the book or the time period? What goes into that decision?
Yeah, all of those things, Anne-Marie. You know, it's an easy decision to make for me whether a book is going to be a part of my series or whether it's going to be a standalone. The Cork O'Connor series have all kinds of elements that I know readers expect me to include in the story. And so when a story comes to me for the Cork O'Connor series, it contains or suggests so many of those elements. The standalones, what I love about the standalones, one of the limitations of writing a popular series is that you are, in fact, limited in terms of what you really can do, the reach of what you can do because of the expectations that are associated with the series. The standalones, it's wide open territory. When I wrote Ordinary Grace, the first, you know, I think of my three standalones, Ordinary Grace, This Tender Land, and The River We Remember, is kind of the Heartland trilogy, if you will. And so the stories that I set in southern Minnesota speak to me in a much larger way. They allow me to go more deeply into questions that are significant to me as an individual, as a human being. So when I wrote Ordinary Grace, one of the reasons I wrote that story was I wanted to explore the importance of the spiritual journey that I believe we're all on, whether you embrace that or not. This Tender Land was a story I'd wanted to write since I was in the fifth grade because of my love of Mark Twain and Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. And so I knew that was going to be a big sort of an epic effort that would not at all fit into the Cork O'Connor stories. And with The River We Remember, because I wanted to talk so significantly about the veterans of World War II and Korea specifically, because those were the veterans I grew up with. Those were the tight-lipped men who were our fathers. I knew it wasn't going to be a Cork O'Connor story. It needed that larger canvas for me to work with. And again, Southern Minnesota is a very Midwestern environment. And I spent so many of my growing up years in the Midwest. And I'm a firm believer that once the Midwest sets a hook in your heart, it always pulls you back. And it certainly has for me. So when I'm thinking about the standalones, typically I'm thinking about a story set in a small Midwestern town, Southern Minnesota. And that then allows my thinking to, you know, the Midwest, it's very broad, it's very expansive, allows my thinking just to be out there as far ranging as it needs to be for the story itself. Does that help?
Yes, it does. I'm wondering, what do you want your readers to take from this book after they finished reading it? And for me, even more importantly, is it the same as what you took from the book, from the experience of writing it?
Yeah, you know, the epilogue in so many ways kind of sums up really what I was getting at. And it comes back to the issue of forgiveness, forgiving ourselves, the necessity to forgive ourselves and to forgive others before our life is over. If we hold on to the grievances, it's like, you know, holding on to a stone, a boulder that just weighs us down and keeps us from living in a real vital way. So if there were a message in it, that would be it. You know, we need to learn how to forgive.
Mm-hmm. And finally, while it might be easy to say the first one, which of your books would you really recommend to a reader who has not read any of your works yet?
Well, if a reader is a mystery reader and really loves the idea of reading a mystery, I would recommend number 18 in my Cork O'Connor series, a book called Lightning Strike, which is a prequel to the entire series and requires no knowledge of the series or the characters or the elements at all to enjoy that story. And if a reader appreciates what I've done and who I am as a storyteller in Lightning Strike, then I would say you should go back to the beginning of the series, Iron Lake, and buy all of the books in the very reasonably priced hardcover edition for your library, permanent library. If you are just wanting to know who I might be as a storyteller, just in general, uh-huh. and mysteries aren't necessarily your cup of tea, you could begin with any of my three standalones. I love them all equally. My heart is invested so completely in each of those three novels.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Emery, thank you so much for joining us. I have a couple of questions from Mark Nichols from Milford, Connecticut. He says, does your writing process differ between the creating of a Quirk O'Connor mystery and working with a standalone? And you've talked about that a little bit, about, you know, you've got some regimens. After 19, thank you, and here's to many more O'Connor books, does the familiarity you have with those characters drive the process in ways that are different from creating new personalities, histories, and relationships in your standalones? And I'm going to ask you something here that Mark doesn't have is, do you have a Bible kind of what these people have done? Because so many times, like somebody will say something, they go, the character can't do that. Like they can't do that. That's not going to work. Remember book four? Do you get along the way?
You know, wouldn't it have been good to create a Bible as I was going along or files, dossiers of everything that the characters are and have accomplished? That would have been such a good idea. But no, that's not how I operate. You know, after writing the Cork O'Connor series for, you know, I began the first book in 1992. What is that, 30 years ago? Mm. I know the characters really well. I have a pretty good idea of what they've done in the past or haven't done in the past. But I admit sometimes I have to go back and do some rereading to make sure that my memory hasn't failed me. And the fact that I am dealing with characters that I know so well in a place that I know so well makes the process of creating the Cork O'Connor stories much easier in many respects than writing the standalones, because I'm not recreating the wheel every time I sit down to write a book. And my familiarity with the characters will, in fact, often guide how the story is going to go, or will help dictate the different paths that I decide it's time for you to become someone else. Mm-hmm. I'm going to help you do that, you know? Particularly the manuscript I'm working on now in the Cork O'Connor series. It should be out this time next year. It will be called Spirit Crossing. A number of the characters take different turns in their lives that will, I'm hoping, surprise readers and maybe please them. Well, I'm hoping it'll please them.
It'll surprise you too. Every once in a while you read back and go, oh, look what I did. Yeah. Look what they're doing now, you know? Your ability to drop hints to the solution of a crime throughout the novel is obviously well-honed through your writing history and is well evident in this novel, but the wealth of life-directing, life-affirming gifts to this reader abound in The River We Remember. In writing this book, do you feel a need to share not only a fine and complete reading experience with your audience, but perhaps a stronger than usual desire to commiserate as well as educate your readers? And I think that, you know, we've talked about that a bit, but it's really like you've got the crime, but.
Yeah, it's not really about the crime. It's about so much more than the crime. I really was, you know, as human beings, we are wounded in so many ways, by so many events and by so many people. In The River We Remember, it's not just the people who are coming back from wars who are wounded. There is domestic abuse is involved in it. Prejudice is involved in it. Being unloved is involved in it. And those are all kinds of woundings. And so I wanted to talk about a whole lot more that was important to me and share it. You know, I created it as a mystery because I'm a mystery writer, and that's what, you know, but I wanted to talk about so much more that was important to me as a human being and that I thought might touch familiar chords with other people as well, as we all struggle with whatever the wounding is that mm-hmm. has occurred in our lives and from whatever the person or the circumstances. And as we struggle to come to a place where we can offer forgiveness and, you know, begin to live a life that's less weighted by all of the anger, the bitterness that we might hold on to if we can't forgive.
Mm-hmm. And you also think about we're not going to give any spoilers away, but what happens to this town afterwards? Because you're so invested with these people. It's like, what was their reaction later? And we're not giving anything away, but it was an interesting thought. Mark Olson from Richfield, Minnesota asks, many of your stories touch on Indigenous culture and often hold up the hard parts of history that need further study. Do you have any resources that you use? We've talked about people to get it as right as you can. And would you be willing to share them with readers? Now, we talked about people, but is there reading you've done that perhaps we could include on your website? Books that you've read, books that you recommend? Because I might know who could put that up on your website for you. I just might know.
Yeah, you know, when I'm doing research, I cover a whole broad range of personal contacts, reading if that's appropriate. When I was writing, for example, This Tender Land, which goes so deeply into the Native American boarding school system, I read a great deal of personal accounts by survivors of that experience. And I found those in a variety of places, in the public library, online. Here in Minnesota, we have a great resource, the Minnesota History Center, mm-hmm. where I was able to uncover a lot of the first person accounts, as well as photographic images of that time and that particular situation. You know, I'd have to go back and take a look at my files. I do keep files on my resources to be able to offer you anything off the top of my head. But what I can do, Carol, is when we have finished, I can send you a list of the resources that might prove helpful to folks, not just in reading about the Ojibwe community or the Nakota community, but just the indigenous situation in this continent in general.
Oh, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. We'd wonderfully be able to share it with our readers as well. Now, Kent, I know you did a trip to the Boundary Waters before you headed to Alaska Territory. I actually thought about doing that trip. And then when you wrote later that it rained the entire time, I realized, no, that wouldn't have been as much fun as I thought it was going to be.
Hey, but we had a great time.
I bet you did. I'm sure you did. I put him too far away from my hairdryer. Let's see, the Boundary Waters before you headed up there. So I'm curious about this next question from Ann Pott from Morrell's Inlet, South Carolina. Would you ever think about venturing north with a story to cover an area less tame than southern Minnesota and with a lot more wilderness?
We're talking maybe about the upper reaches of Canada or Alaska. At the moment, I have no plot in mind that might take me that far. I've come close. Thunder Bay takes us mm-hmm. much farther up into Canada than the Cork O'Connor series, but I haven't really tackled those kinds of wilds before. And at the moment, no idea with me that might take me in that direction.
Carrying the boat.
Is long, so who knows?
I just thought that carrying the boat on my head in the rain would have been good. I probably would have volunteered to do that. What's it called when you carry the boat and you, it's called when you
go over
the line? Yeah.
It's called a portage. But you know, if it's raining and then you're carrying the boat this way, that's fine this way, but there's probably mud under you sucking at your boots and slipping. And so, you know, it's a no-win situation.
Concept off. Okay. All right. We'll stay on dry land with Kent. So we've got one last question from Amy. Well, then we have one more from me. Amy Maywin from Morristown, New Jersey. I love the title of the book, The River We Remember. It's perfect. Were there other titles you considered before you chose this one?
Yeah, for those of you who have read my other standalones, originally the title of this story was going to be This Tender Land. When I bagged the manuscript over 6 years ago and said this just didn't work, I love that title. So I gave it to the book that I ended up writing and publishing in its stead, This Tender Land, because I loved that title. And it was really even more appropriate for that particular story. Mm-hmm. Then when I turned this manuscript into my publisher this time around, the story was called Alabaster, after the river Alabaster. And my editor, who is like the best editor in the entire universe, said, it's not expansive enough. It doesn't tell us enough. You need to give us a different title. And so I was out biking one day, great ideas come to me while I'm on my bike. I was out biking and I was thinking about, okay, there's a river that's important in this, and it's about the past. And somehow those words, the river we remember, came into my thinking. And as soon as it was there, I knew that's the title. My editor just fell in love with it. I love that title as well.
Yeah, it's really perfect. It's really, really perfect. It just says so much about the whole town, the people, just every single thing. So you've shared What's Next for You, which is another Cork title. So I know the audience is asking, as I've been reading the chat, what's going to see a next standalone for you? So when's the next standalone going to be hatched around? Because you've got a waiting audience here.
Yeah, so I have two books in the Cork O'Connor series under contract. I've just finished the first draft of the first of those, and I'm going to hold off starting on the second one so that I can write a standalone. The general idea, general intriguing idea of a standalone has been knocking at my door for quite a while, just really asking me to spend some time with it. So I'll probably spend a couple of years working on that particular story idea, and God willing, I'll be able to bring it to fruition. It will be the story that I'm thinking it has the potential for being, but it'll be a couple of years before that's out then. So, and no title for it at this point.
No title for it. Here's a question. When you're writing River We Remember and you realize there's a great idea you have, but it's not going to work for this book, do you jot it down to possibly use someplace else? Like, is there a pile of Kent almost ideas or Kent ideas for some other time? Or when you're there, you're just in the zone of the book you're working on?
Yeah, I never jot anything down. There are things that I've worked on in the past that I never throw away. As a writer, you never throw anything away. But I don't, keep notes or jot things down, typically speaking.
Okay. All right. Kent, thank you for joining us. I thank you on behalf of all the readers who are here today, those that came on screen, those in the audience, and those I was asking questions for. We really, really, really appreciate your taking the time to do this for us today. Thank you so very, very much.
Take care, everyone.
Till next time. And I've got a couple of new and more announcements for us. Today's event will be available on YouTube and on our podcast later this week. We'll alert everybody who is here today when that will be happening, and we will send the link to you. Our next Bookuccino Live evening event will be on Wednesday, October 25th, a week from today at 8 p.m., where our guests will be Jody Pico and Jennifer Finney Boylan talking about their book, Mad Honey. My book group read this book, and we had so much conversation about it. Sign up for this event's available now on bookreporter.com and reading group guides. And if you want to ask questions, send it to me, send me your question, whether you want to be on camera or off. And as always, please tell us where you're from, because we like to do that as well. And on Wednesday, November 8th at 2:00, we're going to be hosting our last Bookuccino Live of the year, our book preview event, with a look at November and December, because those months don't have as many books coming out, folks. And a look ahead at January and February, because we've got to give you more. So sign up available about this on Book Reporter right now. Stay on top of what we're doing, of everything, like the event we invented today, our Bookuccino Live, usual events, our monthly event, our contest sign up for our Book Reporter newsletters, and then you'll never miss an event. And remember, we have 175 Book Reporter Talks to Author interviews available, including there's one with Kent where we talked about This Tender Land. And I'm actually going to be sending that to the library in the next town that's going to be discussing that book. So if you ever need to refresh yourself, if you have read the book and you don't quite remember, you can go back and look and see if we have an interview with the author as well and be able to share that at the same time. But to everyone and to Kent, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It was such a pleasure.
Carol, could I just say thank you so much for all that you do for those of us who are writers and those of us who are readers. Thank you.
Thank you so very, very much. That was so kind of you. And to everybody else, we look forward to seeing you very, very soon on another edition of one of the shows that we do, including the one we invented today. Okay. Thanks so much, everyone. Bye now. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The River We Remember by William Kent Kruger, narrated by C.J. Wilson. Coming up after the credits, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. The show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The River We Remember, narrated by C.J. Wilson, courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio.
The Alabasta River cuts diagonally across Black Earth County, Minnesota. A crooked course like a long crack in a china plate. Flowing out of Sioux Lake, it runs 70 miles before crossing the border into Iowa south of Jewell, the county seat. It's a lovely river filled with water that's only slightly silted, making it the color of weak tea. Most folks who've grown up in Black Earth County have swum in the river, fished its pools, picnicked on its banks. Except in spring, when it's prone to flooding, they think of it as an old friend. On quiet nights, when the moon is full or nearly so, and the surface of the Alabaster is mirror still and glows pure white in the dark bottomland, to stand on a hillside and look down at this river is to fall in love.